You could have done the P-A-R-T. Why? Because I've gotta. You could have done that.
I could have. You're right. Yeah, I could have.
That
option was on the table.
Did you see my hand was so close to the on button that you knew you were like, I got to speed through this because otherwise he might do the Jim Carrey line?
I encourage you to do the Jim Carrey one.
Well, that's, you know what? Friendship. That's what we got going on here. I have a dilemma I did not know I was going to have on my hands here that we're going to have to get to at some point before the end of the show.
Okay.
You learn something about people you love every day. It's not always things you want to learn. Yeah. Yeah. Ooh, deep tease, right? Yeah, that was...
Sounds deep.
That was existential, huh?
Okay.
Wow.
Okay.
Joe Varden coming up in about 20 minutes here. But the lead brought to you by Slater and Zers. Experience you need, results you want. Eric Enholm joined us at the top of the 3 o'clock hour to break down the Browns' schedule. Cleveland with no primetime games and a gauntlet to begin the year. Here's what he said about the first stretch of games for Cleveland.
You know, I always look at the first handful of games of every team and say, are we looking at 5-0 or 0-5 or somewhere in between, you know? And that's kind of the toughest part with Cleveland, I would say, is getting off to a good start is going to be very difficult.
Yeah, it seems like it's really hard to find wins. You know, I was accused of being a homer, which I think is a wild accusation when you say 6 wins.
Yeah, the Peterlin pander, as it's known.
It's very nice. Again, I've been searching for this zone for about a decade now to be considered the homer, especially between really anybody else at the station. And so I like that we found this comfort zone.
JP is home.
I might just live in it for a little bit, if we're being honest. Wild, though, how if you think this team is going to start 0-5, which I definitely think is more than on the table, where you find the other wins.
Yeah, like, you can kind of dice this thing up how you want it. If you think that there's a part of me that does subscribe to the belief system of the early season is so wonky and teams are still coming together that if it might look tough on paper and then you get in and those teams aren't quite ready to be who they are. So maybe having the bulk of your toughest games early gives you a chance to sneak a couple wins. At the same point, there are a few scenarios in which I think Kevin Stefanski ends up getting in hot seat territory in season. And if, let's say, you're one of the teams that aren't ready to play early in the season, I just think it's under-talked about. And I know the players are going to say things differently, but you're coming off a 3-win season. I think Kevin's in a precarious situation in that locker room, meaning he's not walking into a precarious situation, but if they start the season 1-5 or 0-6, which is how that schedule looks like it could happen, you're going to get into some quicksand there really easy, and it's going to be tough to get the kind of positive momentum you need, even if you get a couple easy games in the middle of the season with the Jets and the Titans.
Well, and if you're Stefanski, you got to be thinking, man, I couldn't catch a break here. That's as tough as you're going to find. He probably was up last night being like, you couldn't have had me open with the Titans into the Jets, into the Raiders, and let me take just a lazy river ride before I just get slaughtered with these opponents?
And I do think, you can't control the dance card. You gotta take them as they come. But, like, listen, if you go out there and go 3-3 in those first 6 games, we're going to have some hope. That's going to jumpstart some hope. I don't know we should go into the season saying that's what will happen.
Well, yeah, because if you go 3-3, that means you've beaten, out of the 6 games to start off, if Aaron Rodgers is with the Steelers, you go through Joe Burrow, Lamar Jackson, Jordan Love, Jared Goff, into J.J. McCarthy, which is, that's a mixed bag, that's a grab bag, that's a 15-win team from last year, and then into Aaron Rodgers. Like, that is 5 respectable to great quarterbacks that you're playing.
It is. Tough. It's funny you mention Minnesota. I was listening to WIP, and John Ritchie, former NFL linebacker.
I like him. He's the one that did the show with Artie Lang for so many years.
He is
the overnight show that I talk about every now and again.
We appreciate him, but he said he referred to Kevin O'Connell as an up-and-comer, and I'm like, 13 wins. He's had 13 win in a 14-win season in 2 of his first 3 seasons.
Yeah, all he's done is win.
A 667 winning percentage in 3 years. It's a little bit more than an up and comer.
Yeah, that's a miss by John Ritchie.
That Matt LaFleur.
You would have hated.
He's got some moxie.
I don't know how John is on that show on IP. You would have hated him on Artie's show because he was just a he was wallpaper.
Did he just say, Diana.
No, he was not Diana. Chase Daniel.
Artie, hey. What are we doing? Artie, what are we doing?
No, he was his role was to just sit back and basically nod his head and never speak as Artie Lang just went off on tangents. And I loved it. I loved every second of it. Jarrett Greenberg joined us last hour talking Cavs. Here's what he said about everyone calling out the team's toughness.
I'd be annoyed by it if I was on the Cleveland Cavaliers. Like, people just say it as a throwaway line at this point that the Cavs are not tough. What does that mean? What in what area are they not tough enough? Sometimes you're just not good enough, or sometimes the other team's better than you. You're using the same terminology and labels that you've used for the last 5 years on this team when it's a different group year in and year out.
I don't think mental toughness was the problem. I don't think physical toughness was the problem for the Cavs. You had four of your six best players playing through significant injuries, and even though Philadelphia, I think, was better at staying within the margins of physicality, I think the Cavs matched physicality better than they did in the Knicks series 3 years ago, better than the Orlando series 2 years ago, and certainly better than the Boston series, which is wild because that's not a physical Boston team. To me, if there's a question about toughness, we're talking about mental toughness. And that's, how do you quantify that? I don't know. Watch Indiana. They never shied away from a moment. Whenever things got the way things got, they never really caved.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what you call it. I don't know if you call it mental toughness. I don't know what term you want to use with it. But I do know in a must-win game, when you lead by 5 at the half, to then go 17 of 18 missed shots and 8 minutes of game time in the third quarter without hitting a shot, Nick, that's something that you need to find a way to, you know, be better at.
And I actually thought all the Cavs did a heck of a job of just being like, yeah, this wasn't what we signed up for. Like, I gave them
credit yesterday. I thought they owned it in a way that was impressive, because after the Boston series last year, I didn't feel like anyone really did that.
I didn't feel the lights were too bright moment. I didn't feel, which I think Jarrett said in like a tongue-in-cheek way, and then it blew up. I think he's acknowledged that since, like, and I think they did, like, I think to a man, everyone was like, yeah, it's not about the injuries, it's not about this. We just didn't do the job. Odyssey NBA insider Danny Green joined Baskin and Phelps today and had this to say about the core four in Cleveland.
It's working. Obviously, you guys had a 60-plus game season. You just had a bad matchup. It looks like Indiana had beat you guys prior to the playoffs. You know, you got DeAndre Hunter later in the season. Ty Jerome also didn't play. No, it's just sometimes this way the cookie crumbles, right? Some guys have an off night, some guys have an on night. They had a lot of things go right for them, and you guys had a couple of things go wrong.
It's not what I would do. I've said this, but I do think it is what's going to happen. I feel like Kobe Altman's going to do the same thing he did last year, and he's going to run it back another season. This is the roster he put together. I think it's really hard as a GM or a president of basketball operations to have a roster you put together that has been lauded, that won 64 games, and say something's broke. He didn't do it last year. I don't think he's going to do it this year.
I think in a way, the second apron ambiguity, the second apron, I think the ambiguity of who's going to be available, who's not, I think all those things actually favor in the Cavs. If the worst thing Kobe does is stand pat, I get it. Now that's going to lead to more questions going into next year, and there's going to be a how can you actually do it? Okay, don't care. If the worst thing you can do is no moves at all other than re-sign Ty Jerome, we're okay. But I also think you have to have every difficult question stemming from anybody that isn't Evan. And that includes Donovan, that includes Darius, that includes Jarrett. And I think you have to keep an open mind.
Have you seen what Ty Jerome cost, by the way, with the second apron?
Didn't Bobby say if he's $14 million a year, that means he's going to cost an extra $80
million? Yeah. I mean, Gilbert's got a lot of money.
Well, but what's the option is you lose him and can't replace him.
I get it, but think about that for a second. If you're Dan Gilbert, you're like, wait, so $14 million for Ty Jerome is going to cost me $80 million. How cool with that am I? He's worth $30 billion. He could totally eat the money if he wanted to. It just, is Ty Jerome going to be that much of a difference for the team? You can make an argument he will be, but that is unprecedented, the amount of money to take back for a Ty Jerome.
But we went through a lot of different possibilities. Maybe we will have to do what Anthony Alant suggested, that we would do the trade machine version of Mock Me.
Yeah, but he didn't say he had enough trades ready to go.
Oh, no, we're not going to do that today.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
But maybe if we, like, I'm sure between him and Mac. The problem is, It can't be them generated. We've got to actually find other people submitting them and then go from there.
So yesterday I made the claim, and I want your thoughts on it. I think the second apron, if the Cavs stay in the second apron, it's not great for us in the sports talk radio business, because we can't even fantasize about Giannis coming here, about Booker coming here, about any of those guys that you Zion, any of those guys that you'd have the pie in the sky dreams for. You can't even do it because of the second apron.
What do you think about Jared Allen for Rui Hachimura and a first round pick?
There we go. Let's talk.
Let's do it. Let's jump to the Cavs, the Gardos, to close this out.
Let's do it. Guardians start a 3-game series with the Reds tomorrow. Are you looking for some revenge on Terry Francona?
Yes.
Wait, no, hold on. We had a big debate about how much you'd be keeping track of the Reds this season, because you said you wanted Terry basically to eat it. What is the Reds' current record right now?
I'm going to go there 21 and 19.
21 and 24. They're three games under 500.
I was so close.
You had them two games over 500.
Yeah. Well, no, but I got the 21 part.
You did. Right. You had the number of wins correct.
So I knew that.
Yes, you did.
Got that going for me.
Which is nice.
No, I jest a little bit. The reality is, I think Tito and ownership in front office just reached a point where Tito wasn't healthy. I'm sure that factored in. I'm sure he got frustrated with how things had gone a specific way after spending up until like 2018. Totally get it. At the same point, he waited 1 year and took a bad Cincinnati job. Like, that still infuriates me. Like, if he had gone to New York, I'd be like, I get it. Yeah, if he'd gone to the Dodgers, or if he'd gone to a big market team where they spend a lot of money and they have a I would get it. And
or if he went back to Boston or something.
Would totally have gotten it. He went to Cincinnati. So was it really a retirement, or was it just a year to play golf and wait for a job that he felt better about than the Guardians?
I think we know what it was. And I don't harbor any ill will. I am as invested into the Reds as I thought I would be, which is very, very little.
For now. Until this series. The lead brought to you by Slater and Zurs. Experience you need. Results you want. What do the Cavs do to get better from here? We'll ask that. And talk about the Cavalapse. Huh? Instead of a Cavalanche, Cavs Collapse, Cavalapse? You're right. It's not great. I'll do better. Joe Vartan in 5 minutes on 92.3 The Fan. Back on Afternoon Drive, Nick Wilson, Jonathan Peterlin with you. We got plenty to get to on today's show. More Browns talk on the way. We do have quick hits coming up at 6 o'clock, but our next guest got a up row front seat for the Cavaliers. The debacle. I know what I said. Up row. I know. Don't give me that look. I hate all of you. Now,
I was going to let it go.
I would like to point out, it was the looks that hurt. I would like to point out that Z on Twitter saying he thinks Collapsaliers is better than Cavalapse. I will admit, Collapsaliers made me laugh quite a bit.
It's pretty good. We're workshopping it. We'll get there, maybe.
So to talk about the Collapsaliers and the latest gentleman sweep that ended their regular season, our next guest actually has something he published earlier today on the Collapsaliers, as they're called. Now it feels personal. Now I've said it three times. But it felt personal. This series felt personal. We're going to go out to the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram hotline and welcome in of The Athletic, the great Joe Vartan. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hey, Nick. How's it going?
I mean, I thought it'd be going better at this point. I thought it was on pace to maybe being razzed about taking vacation across games 2 through 4 of the NBA Finals, and then the Cavs aren't in it, so I guess it doesn't matter.
I guess it doesn't. You know, the story that I published does have the word collapse in the headline. But I think that using that word is maybe not entirely fair. It certainly is fair to the Cavs' regular season compared to what happened in the playoffs. But I don't know how anybody could have watched that series and not thought that the Pacers were the better, tougher team. I think the Pacers are going to be really hard to deal with in the conference finals, and maybe the finals too, so long as they stay healthy. They're ridiculous with the pace that they play. And when you say pace, you think about how a team pushes the ball and runs in transition, but that's not it here. Kenny said it best. They play like a college team, and he meant that as a phrase of endearment. They press full court the whole game, and then take the ball out from under the basket and go, or get a rebound and go. So, you know, the Knicks, I mean, they play six guys. It's going to be hard for them to do that over seven games. The Celtics, obviously, Tatum's gone, and something's really wrong with Porzingis, so they're behind. So, you know, we're not real happy as Clevelanders about the juxtaposition between the regular season and the postseason for the Cavs, but the Pacers are really good.
Yeah, what surprised me the most, Joe, I mean, the Pacers ended up with six different guys in double digits in scoring, and if you would have told me a team did that before the series started, I'd have been against the Cavs, you know, a team that Atkinson routinely said, we have the best 6 through 10 in the entire NBA. The difference for me was in a lot of that, and the trust that Donovan seemed like he didn't have in a lot of those guys, especially late in Game 5.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was a lopsided affair when it comes to reserves. I mean, you got to think about, like, TJ obviously dominated Ty Jerome. I meant TJ McClellan. How about that? That's Ty Jerome's initials. Didn't mean that. All right. So anyway, McConnell, he won that one going away. Obi Toppin, much better than DeAndre Hunter this series. It's not close. We're not going to argue that. And Benedict Mathurin, other than, you know, the cheap shot of punching DeAndre in the chest, he was awesome. So yeah, I mean, that's another one where, you know, it didn't really matter who Kenny turned to off the bench. I mean, Isaac and Dean were good for like a quarter of game five, excuse me. We know about Jerome in this series. You know, Sam was kind of, didn't really, you know, he had one good game, I believe, not available for game five either. So, yeah, I mean, that was a strength. And we all said it all year that the Cavs are deep. They're versatile. They got deeper with DeAndre. That's all true. It just wasn't true in this series.
Joe Vardin in the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. So I was perusing your story on the Cavaliers here before
Wait
the show.
A minute. You should be reading it word by word.
I perused first, and then I went back and devoured it like the Harry Potter books. So you made a point about Donovan being able to, whether it's put pressure in the front office or his coach or the organization without maybe doing it directly. So can you expound on your point? Was Donovan using the media when he said that they could go 82-0 next year and people would count them out?
No, I think at that one, he was just kind of like expanding on the point that he was making, where I do think he was trying to use the media. And just to be clear, I mean, I said this in the story too, but, you know, I met him in 2019, the first Team USA that I covered. He was on that team in China. We were all over that country for a month. The next year was the bubble. I was in the bubble, so was he. And then he's been here for 3 years. So, you know, I've seen him, and I've kind of seen him grow up, and certainly in Cleveland, I'm just like, I find him to be like LeBron level in terms of understanding business and understanding the power that he has. And so all of that being said, when I listen to him after game five, knowing him as I do, he is too smart to be like saying that in earnest. Like if those comments were taken at face value, then basically you have a star player on a team that was one of the best teams in NBA regular season history, get punked at home three times and lose a series that they were heavily favored 4-1, and turn around and preemptively whine about coverage. There's no way Donovan Mitchell did that. No way. So what was he doing? Okay, he and I haven't had this discussion. So yes, this is a little bit of conjecture on my part. But knowing him as I do and laying out what I just laid out, I believe that he was opening the door and or encouraging the criticism to come forth in the specific areas for how this team got beat. He knows, like, he knows he didn't shoot it well. He knows there was one bad turnover at the end of game two, but he knows he played his tail off. He knows he played hurt. He knows he averaged 32 point whatever points per game. He knows that. Come on. He's not even expecting the criticism to come at him. He knows which players and, like, collectively what happened, but he doesn't want to sit up on the dais and say that. Okay. And, you know, I'm not in the locker room with these guys when the doors are closed, but I don't think he's in there, you know, finger pointing and that kind of thing. But, you know, saying what he said certainly opened the door for that, for some of the individual, like, sort of point by point, well, this is what went wrong and this is what you guys need to fix so this doesn't happen next year.
Well, from your perspective, then, if we removed Donovan from any of the blame, where would you put the blame?
Well, so at the end of the piece, Kenny, in one of the many things he said, you know, Evan, and he said Evan a couple times. Once he said Evan will get a little better, Evan will get a little stronger. You know, he said the same thing about Darius. I think there are three basic problems, okay? One is the maturity level of some of the players. I know we've been talking about toughness. I know we've been talking about enforcers. I still think that stuff is overrated. And I still think that, like, you know, Tristan and Shump and JR, you know, that team we all loved in 16, like, yeah, those guys played with chips on their shoulders, but they're not like brawlers. You know, they're not going to go put you in a headlock. So I think the toughness, I think the enforcing stuff is a little overrated, but so we all say that the maturity is one thing. I talk a little bit about culture. And I've been writing about this a little bit and talking about it a little bit. I think that is a thing. And then the third thing that I think is probably the only thing that I don't know if they can play around is the small guards. Okay. So I think that whoever you want to say, needs to mature a little bit, toughen up a little bit. I think they can, and I think they will. I think given the time, you know, I'm not ruling that out for anybody. People can evolve, and these are young men. Like, they're young. And I know that, like, Darius has been in these playoffs now a bunch, and I guess so is Evan. But Evan's, like, what, 22 or 23? Like, the sky is still the limit for that guy. So that can be fixed. The culture stuff I'm talking about, and again, like everybody, like, people need to take a second to listen to this. Like, the Cavs, when LeBron left, they needed to find a way to make themselves attractive to people who were never from here. You know, the weather stinks. We know that. The taxes are too high. We know that. We live here. We love it. We know that too. But free agents don't. Okay. So that, you know, the Cleveland's reputation was what it was. And so they had to figure out a way to make this place more attractive. And what they did was they created a culture where the players are protected and empowered. And I am not necessarily criticizing that. It has worked. The Cavs have a positive reputation in the league among players. They are protected during the regular season. They feel it. They feel good about being here. They're upset when they get traded away. Okay? But the culture of that and sort of like what that means and what that represents, we have seen now in two consecutive playoffs where we get a player or multiple players who are questionable with injuries and they end up not playing. Now, that could be a reporting issue, which is also an organizational thing. You know, maybe these guys are really hurt, like way worse than questionable. And the organization plays these, like, sort of, you know, cloak and dagger games with their opponents. And what ends up happening is fans and media, but fans mostly, I mean, I can show you guys my texts from all the people I grew up with, you know, how upset they were throughout, like, the rest of Miami series and throughout the first few games of this one. And the same thing last year with what happened with Jared Allen. So it's either we have a culture where players are not used to playing through injuries, or we have, like, an organization that's kind of being a little loose with the questionable language like trying to accomplish one thing, and then what ends up happening is like the players kind of get extra pressure put on them at home. Okay, that can be fixed. Here's the third thing. Darius Garland, a two-time All-Star, good player. He's 6'1", listed. Is he taller than me? Maybe. Yeah, probably, but I'm 5'10". I'm 5'10". Donovan is listed at 6'3". Once I went up to him and I said, are you really 6'3"? And he's like, yeah. But the look on his face, like, he kind of got it. So, anyway, even if those guys are the heights that they're listed, there have only been three teams in NBA history to win a title with two guards that are both under 6'4", we'll say. Okay? Three. I don't know if they can get around that, especially as physical and as fast-paced and as much of this game that is played on the perimeter now. I mean, look at how physical Naismith and Nembhard were on the perimeter. Like, forget about the banging in the paint of the 90s, and the 80s and the 90s and the early 2000s. No. This game is a battle on the perimeter. And I am concerned that despite how good those two players are, and that they can even play together and have the best offense in the NBA this year, best offense in franchise history. Like, so it's not like they can't score the ball together, can't play together, but when you get into these playoff situations, history tells us that it's very hard to win with two smaller guards. And that is my number one concern about this team. It's not the maturity and the toughness we all talk about, and it's not even this one culture issue that I scream about. It's the two small guards.
Joe, do they stand pat this summer?
You know, Nick, I mean, I think they can. You know, I think, you know, I this small guard thing that I just went nuts about, like I wrote about it. I posed it to Kenny and to some of the people in the organization, and they feel like Donovan plays bigger. So they don't think this is a problem. And so if the other two things are true, if you can fix those other two things, like I think that 64 wins, like that is legitimate. And I just think, you know, they got outplayed and outclassed in this series. And like, there is, like, you know, ask the Pittsburgh Steelers, the Miami Heat, or even the Yankees, you know, of the, like, sort of like the, you know, the good reasons to continually run it back. You stay together, you grow together, you know, you eventually get to the finals. Maybe you win the Super Bowl, whatever. So they can run it back. They might have to because of the second apron and how much money they will be paying already. It makes it really hard to make trades. If they could move Jared Allen to diversify the roster, but do it in the way that they think makes sense, then I think they would listen. If they could move Darius for an impact bigger player, but he's got to be an impact player, then I think you do. You know, like, I mean, there's, for instance, like Orlando is kind of stuck as sort of that like 5-7 seed, and they can't shoot and they can't move the ball, and they have Paolo Banchero. They have no point guards. So, you know, if Orlando was interested in Darius, would they part with Franz Wagner? Well, Franz has the size and the scoring ability that the Cavs would need. And he actually makes slightly less money than Darius, so they could actually do that trade. I'm not saying that is a trade that's even on the table. I'm giving your listeners an example of a deal that would make sense. But they might run it back, and they might have to.
Joe, great stuff as always, buddy. We really appreciate you. And any other nice things you'd like me to say before we let you go?
Not at all. I just... hopefully we'll talk again during the finals.
Great stuff, man. Really appreciate you.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I thought his comments on Donovan were really interesting. I didn't have that perspective of it, and I think he might be right. The idea that wasn't Donovan just facing the music to face the music. That was more him welcoming the idea that he was really good in the series, and he's opening up criticism for everyone else. You just have to then spotlight it and pick it apart.
I mean, do we just have to say that Darius that this is all about Darius?
No, I don't think that's true. I think Jared Allen has taken a lot of heat, and whether that was Jason Lloyd on yesterday, Danny Cunningham on yesterday, said very similar things about Jared Allen and his lack of showing up. Like, I think this is beyond Darius when it comes to the core four. And I think Mobley got a lot of positive attention for what he did in Game 5, but I think there were even some Mobley skeptics out there too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say, you know, Mobley did some, but maybe didn't do enough in the postseason comparative to his jump in the regular season.
Yeah, I think that's very fair, yeah. So, especially in the spot with the first half where you really kind of dominate because of Mobley. And he did as much as he could in Game 5. Game 5 wasn't about him. But in the third quarter when you needed a bucket and you needed an answer and you got that 8-minute stretch where you didn't score a single basket and went 17 of 18, that would have been a good time to maybe Mobley be able to do something.
Yeah, it would have been a nice time for the guards to stand down, I would say. Like, I thought there was a very clear push and pull offensively in a couple of the games where, I mean, your size, Indiana really didn't have. Miles Turner's a nice rim protector, but he's not like a truly great defender.
And he looked all defense in that
like,
game.
You know,
he was blocking everything.
I think my point is, like, you would have Mobley and Allen, and they would be going to the cup, and they'd be going with force, and then all of a sudden the guards would start jacking up three-pointers. So, like, I do think, like, there's a part of me that's like, man, I think if you had just ridden the bigs a little bit more, maybe you don't get bounced out of this thing in five games.
No question.
And it's funny because that is a player decision. That is Donovan feeling the pressure of shooting like crap from three, and I have to make this bucket. And the same thing of Darius, by the way. Hey, I can't drive the same way. I'm going to take this ill-advised three-pointer. And then if that trickles down from a lot of other guys who are like, well, we made our bones on on three-pointers, it's like, Jack, you're up 10 points.
At the half, inside they were plus 20, and from the perimeter they were minus 21 at the half. And a combined Donovan and Darius collectively were 5 of 21 from the field, and you still had a four-point lead.
But it's funny, like, people will then go, well, that's on JB, or that's on Kenny Atkinson. And it's like, guys, okay, a literal inbound pass was the problem in game two. That's not the conceit of the play.
Right.
Like, the problem with JB is it was just, hey, why don't you go out there and pass the ball in? Like, they were like, that's different.
Like, you're
than
on the playground, yeah.
We actually had a play, and so it's funny, like, I've seen this pro JB Bickerstaff narrative emerge, and I'm like, guys, I don't, like, if you look at your rotations, Kenny Atkinson tried plenty of stuff. It just didn't work. If you want to talk about inbounds plays, if you want to talk about, honestly, one of the biggest things that Kenny did absolutely do that stymied Rick Carlisle for two straight games was the switch to the zone defense, which Indy didn't have an answer for until game four. Now, in fairness, then Kenny didn't have a rebuttal, but that's not a play that JB Bickerstaff is running 2 years ago.
Sure.
So, like, it's weird, like, listen, none of this is just to cycle back to the fact that I don't think JB is a good postseason coach. I think this is about player stubbornness. I think it was about pressing, and I think it was about a roster that is wonkily built that I think you're going to continue to come up against for multiple times. I actually think I saw enough from Kenny in these postseason, no matter how it went, to feel like his style of coaching does fit going forward.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. But the hard part, I think, and what fans are maybe, you know, kind of wrestling with is that, you know, going into the season, and then when you started having success, you started convincing yourself that this was a Mark Jackson to Steve Kerr type transition, where this was going to be the spot where he was not only the guy to get you over the hump in the regular season, but also the guy in the postseason. And now it looks like the honeymoon might be over from that respect. And that's okay. He'll have time to go ahead and right that wrong, but for the time being, I understand where there's some frustration from fans, for sure.
Oh, no, listen, I don't think Kenny was flawless, but I just think the idea, honestly, I don't think the Miami series goes the way it is with JB Bickerstaff, because I don't think the regular season goes the way it went with JB Bickerstaff.
Sure, and I tend to fall back on, especially in, like, big series, especially the Pacers series, you know, execution and what the players are able to do has to be the biggest part of all of this, right? And if the players aren't, if you're not hitting shots, how much of that is really Kenny Atkinson's fault?
Like, do we think that Kenny went to Donovan and said, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're our only hope. I'm going to need the ball to stick in your hands. I would venture to say he probably went to Donovan, Darius, the entire team and said, you know, it'd be really great if we could get back to our offense.
Yeah, I'm
going to go ahead and say he said something like that.
I'm going to bet he didn't plan for up until the final minute in the fourth, the previous 13 possessions all ending in a Donovan Mitchell shot. I'm going to guess he didn't have that on the card. He was in a bind. And it's just how the game unfolded. And that is part of it, though. You have to trust your playmakers in those moments. And, they didn't get the job done.
Everyone is owed blame. The blame isn't equal on all fronts for the Cavs. If I'm starting a you-know-what list of guys that I'm not thrilled with in the postseason in general, I don't know, Kenny cracks the top five.
I don't know that he cracked my top five either, but you'd have to acknowledge the idea that I think for a lot of Cavs fans, he's not perceived the way that he was entering the postseason.
That's fine.
Yeah, he'll get over
because
it.
Because in fairness, the stock might have been slightly over-elevated anyways. Because you had just come off just beating the pants off Miami.
I mean, I think people generally did think you just now got Steve Kerr and it was the Warriors transition.
There's still time. He's still young. He can do this.
He's not that young.
Whoa.
He can still do it, but
whoa.
He's not that young.
Whoa. Quick hits coming up in 5 minutes on 92.3 The Fan.